I hope this is not indicated. Maybe it doesn't matter. The low attendance at the Pan Am Games. Anyway, I've been mulling over these questions. When I got the invitation, I thought I qualified because I've been mulling over these questions for a number of years. Nathan and I have this thing where we chat about, we've written a book together out of left field, but we also have this ongoing discussion about basketball and the NBA and so on and so forth. And every so often I tell him I'm quitting, I'm not watching anymore. And he gets mad and says, why? And then I resume and then I quit and it goes back and forth like that. But the reason I go back and forth is for precisely these reasons about social inequality and how much can you be a participant or a spectator in an enterprise which is highly and unequal, highly, if you're talking about basketball, highly racist, highly, you know, exploitative and so on and so forth. But over the years, what I've learned is that, you know, solely making a negative argument can only last so long. Like, you feel bad for some time and then you go back to watching. It's just like the NBA lockout and the NHL lockout. People, oh yeah, that's it. I'm, you know what I mean? I'm not watching. And then all of a sudden, what happens? They go back, right? So that's a kind of one of the tensions that I've been trying to work with, right? Is this, how do we, in a way, effectively unplug from this enterprise that's high-performance sport, which is, you know, multi-billion-dollar enterprise, and it's captivating so much of our energy and time and love and devotion and whatever. You know, people get divorced over these things, have fights, etc., etc. So I just thought I would lay out a few of the main arguments that have been posed in the course that I teach. I teach two courses on high-performance sport. One of them we go through a main series about high-performance sport, philosophical theories, and then I'm going to show you some clips from the film Hoop Dreams, which is a dated film, I accept. It's a dated film. It's 1995, I believe, or 94. But somehow, it's, you know, 20 years old. It somehow keeps being relevant. And so I thought, when we watch the clips, you know, instead of me giving conclusions about the clips, which I could, I would really welcome your take on what's happening, because I'm actually at a bit of a crossroads. I'm not exactly sure what's happening. And so this tentative title for my talk, we had to give titles, right?
Yeah.
So my title was called Spectacle or Studio, Alienation and Concentration in Hoop Dreams. And the reason I use the word spectacle is from Guy Debord's book, Society of the Spectacle, which is, you know, also dated, but still a somehow important text on spectatorship and what it means to be a fan. And the basic argument there is that the spectator, you know, capitalism has shaped itself such that we live in a society of the spectacle. The more we watch the spectacle, or the more the proletariat watch the spectacle, the more they're alienated, the more they are alienated from their species being, from their productivity, right? So that's the main argument, and it's a compelling argument, right? And so he goes over in detail, you know, a few hundred pages, why that's the case. And ultimately, he argues that the proletariat have to become the class of, they have to represent themselves. They can't let, you know, mass dominant culture, capitalism, represents life for them. So anyway, that's just a refresher on the Debord's Society of the Spectacle, right? The other argument, of course, that we discuss. So in that sense, he's arguing that the spectator is alienated by capitalism from being a spectator. By virtue of being a spectator, she or he is alienated from that process, right? And he argues that, you know, the reason why that's done is because, you know, capitalism exploits people. They work a long day. They come home and they need to somehow recharge or decompress, whatever the word you want to use. And so they click on the spectacle, and then they, you know, zone out, and then the next morning they do it again. The problem, obviously, is that zoning out is built on someone else's labor, right? So the other arguments, which started a while back, but originally also, you know, popularized by a French theorist called Jean-Marie Brome, who said that, you know, sport is alienation, sport is exploitation, it's turning athletes into robots, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's the two arguments about alienation. So to recap, you may all know this, but the two arguments that I'm facing with, the one argument says that the fans are alienated, the other argument says the players are alienated. So then the question is, okay, who isn't alienated? Like, is it just that everybody gets alienated in capitalism, or is somebody not alienated? Maybe you could argue, of course, that the owners aren't alienating, the owners of the TV, and the owners of the teams aren't alienated. Fine. But I'm not concerned necessarily with studying their position, but that's possibly what's implicit in those arguments, right? So C.L.R. James, of course, wrote in the 60s, he wrote that book, Beyond a Boundary, and he was a Marxist, he was a Trotskyist, he wrote the famous book in the 30s, The Black Jacobins, and he was I don't know if everybody knows the story of C.L.R. James, but he was a very dedicated, a very good cricketer. You know, he lived a very good cricketer, then he became a cricket coach. He was also, he had left for England to become a writer of cricket. So he wrote for The Guardian, that's how he made his money. He didn't make a lot of money, but he made some money, he made a living by virtue of that. You know, and he just used to eat tea and stale biscuits to get by, but that's what he did, right? When he wrote Beyond the Boundary, he went actually to Mexico. He was he always traveled. He was moving. Janelle has a book, Sword in the Black Atlantic, which I am eager to read. But James, as we know, is a Black Atlantic figure in the tradition that Paul Gilroy discusses, which is that they don't see themselves as located in a particular nation state. They see themselves as part of a diaspora, part of a larger collective of people of African descent. And so James moved around. He started in Trinidad and Tobago, then he went to England, then he went to the States. He was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. He ended up being there for 15 years. While he was in the States, went to Mexico to visit Trotsky and had a discussion with him about capitalism, Trotskyism, socialism, and so on and so forth. The results of that discussion are written down in a book that we have at the York Library, a tiny book. But the main conclusion that he had is in the book called Beyond a Boundary, which I teach in my third year course. And what he argues is that unlike Trotsky and unlike today's Noam Chomsky, he argues that sport for spectators of sport and in his case, in the Caribbean, in the 50s, was not alienating. Why? Because they have this, he argued that in an essay called What is Art? Everybody has, all humans have this quest for beauty, he argued, right? He sort of laid it down all the way from early human societies, what he called primitive societies, up until contemporary societies. And this quest for beauty is what he called the eye for the line, right? Or the curve. So he said that the eye for the line or the curve is just like you go and look at a sculpture, you look for the curve. Or if you go to look at a painting, you look at the curve in which the artist, you know, how she portrays what is she representing, right? And so it's the curve that we have this eye for, and it captivates us, right? It captivates us. And it takes us away. And that's what he argues explains the appeal of sport, because it's the curve. Now, the difference, he argues, from fine art, which you could call what was then called high art, is that that's static. So you see a painting by whoever, and that is a static piece. You go to it again and again, but the piece itself is static. He says in sport, the beauty of sport is that the curve is always in motion, right? So no matter what, every time you watch a game, you'll see a different curve, you'll see a different line. And that was another argument he was arguing against the kind of Matthew Arnold position that there was such thing as culture and there was another thing called barbarism. He was saying, no, there's no barbarism, there's culture everywhere, and which is actually the beginning of cultural studies, really that, for me anyway, one of the main beginnings of cultural studies is that argument. But nobody has no culture. This is culture just like anybody else, right? You know what I mean? So instead of going to opera or ballet or art gallery, you go to cricket and you watch the curve, right? You're watching the line. And the beauty is that the line always moves, right? So, James, did he argue that sport was alienating? No. So, that's another take on it. I'm just throwing it out there. It's another take. He said there's a side for the line. Now, the trouble is, or the question is, you know, so he saw no contradiction whatsoever. Now, he was writing in the 50s and 60s, before, really, I think, for this kind of high-performance sport, right? You know, there was salaries and so on and so forth, but it wasn't like you have this FIFA World Cup and FIFA Women's World, all the TV rights and all that stuff. So anyway, but I just thought I'd put that out there to say that there is another school of thought on alienation other than the Trotsky line or the contemporary Noam Chomsky line or the Brougham line, which is to say that sport distracts people from their political preoccupations, and so on and so forth. So anyway, James, of course, is influential to me. All of them are influential to me, but it's trying to map exactly what's... So the hard part I'm having, truthfully, is finding out exactly what where to make your claim about alienation, right? You know what I mean? So what I decided to do for this presentation is to say, is to show some clips from Hoop Dreams, and I'm just effectively thinking out loud, really, to show you something about spectatorship. And what I'm trying to show in this, this series of clips is how the athletes themselves are watching, what their relation is to the spectator. Because I think that we may have something here. I could be totally wrong. So anyway, I don't know, has anybody seen Hoop Dreams? Has everybody not seen it? Okay, Hoop Dreams follows two young African-American teens who are trying to make the NBA, and they start out in Chicago. Some of you know, it's very highly competitive. And so you start in grade 8 on your journey towards the NBA. So you can imagine if anybody knows somebody who's 13 or whatever, it's a pretty intense kind of process. And they're scouted, and they go to these different schools, and so on and so forth. So they are on a path to being in the NBA. They don't make it, but that's also part of the story, right? So I'm going to start at, I'm just going to start here, very early, and pardon me if I'm skipping through, because... So this is the spectacle. This is where they live. Nothing has changed, sadly, except maybe the living conditions might be even worse. So I'm going to just show, what I'm trying to show you is how they watch, what their relation is to the spectacle. In this particular clip, you can see why they're watching for not alienating reasons. They're watching to, in fact, they're going to school, right? They're trying to watch to figure out how it's done so they can do it themselves. So let me get you, that was William Gates. I'm just going to skip along. Arthur A.G. was the second
protagonist. He's just doing something that he loves so much. He just loves it so much. And tell me, I'm just happy for him.
Yeah, somebody can understand the way William played. That made me feel a lot better, I say, where they think they should have understood the way I play.
Six-one, Isaiah Howard.
So this is Arthur.
I'm going first thing I'm gonna do, I'm gonna go see my mama. I'm gonna buy a house. I'm gonna go out there and make sure my sister and my brother's okay. Probably get my dad Cadillac Oldsmobile so he can cruise in the game.
He dreams about it. You look at those basketball commercials where they be advertising like these Nike shoes, and he'll tell his little small brother, Joe, that's me.
Okay, so that, then again, he does a turn. So they, the filmmakers have juxtaposed this, but I'm just focusing on what, how they watch. If we can.
Make sure you look at how many shots been taken. Jordan might shoot 15 out of 40.
15 out of 40.
I'm just saying for instance, he done it. See, if you do that, you don't know about it.
Curtis tell William the most important thing is getting the ball in the basket. Curtis said the boy's good. He said he's real good. He said, but he don't listen. He said, if you listen to him, he'd be better.
They always tell me, well, you should do this and you should do that. It's like everybody I know is my coach.
But I know a whole lot about basketball. I guess in so many words, I feel like I'm a pro at that in my mind.
So there's another instance of how they're watching, right? And you see something very different from, alienated spectators, you know what I mean? They're really trying to focus. Curtis, I don't know if any of you know, that's William's older brother, who, as you can tell here, was very highly touted, of course, didn't make it, as the story goes on and on. How they watch is really what I'm curious about. So the last scene I'm going to take you to is way toward the end. Yeah, so I'm going to back it up and I'm going to start it. So this is when they
high school ball game.
So this here is Earl Smith, who is the one who brings them, he's the scout. And so the film is now going back to, in the senior year, Earl Smith is, and I don't know if the filmmakers did this or this happened naturally, whatever, but he's now wanting to bring Arthur to the school that William is at to watch a final game. So, and Arthur was at that school in grade 9 in his first year, but ended up being kicked out because he wasn't performing up to standard. So that just gives you some context as to what's going to happen. So, interestingly enough, Arthur ended up at the poor school. He ended up back in Chicago at the poor school, the local school, and ended up doing very well. And the one who went to the private school ended up not doing very well, which is another sort of interesting plot, subplot in Hoop Dreams about being located within, among your people, right? Which is also form of alienation. So anyway, this is Earl, and he's about to invite Arthur to go to this playoff game at the private school, and we'll watch this for about 3-4 minutes.
Man, where you been?
I've been working.
Oh, yeah, right.
I've been working.
Oh, yeah.
By the way,
man. You impressed or something?
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm here. If I wasn't impressed, I wouldn't have
talked to him.
For what?
You want to talk to him alone? I'm not.
What do I have to talk to him about?
I think it's the coach who cut him. That's what he's asking about.
The coach who cut him.
So I was thinking about going tonight to see him in St. Joe at the Astros playing. But I wasn't sure if you had time to do it.
Yeah.
I've got a bitter taste in my mouth about a lot of things that happened. A lot of people accuse me of taking youngsters out in the city and taking them out to St. Joe High School, and they ask when did I get out of the deal, and a lot of racial slurs and so forth from my own people about me, about what I did. I still felt and feel that I was doing the right thing for that particular time. Sometimes I have second thoughts when I see the net results of what happened with youngsters.
For arriving late to the locker room, and Nazareth Prep. William enters the game to go head to head with Nazareth star Sean Pearson, his friend and roommate for the Nike game.
Sidebar here is to watch how Curtis is watching, because it's the same approach, right? He's watching how the student does.
Boulder Chargers race to an early 14-point lead in this second round playoff game. But near the end of the game, St. Joe's begins to unravel. William takes control. Pearson responds. His three-point shot gives the Roadrunners their first lead of the game.
This is what I'm interested in, how these guys are watching.
For the Chargers, their whole season may come down to this possession. Down by one with just over a minute remaining. A loss tonight would be their earliest exit from the playoffs in 6 years. And for William, there is no next year. No more chances to go downstate.
That's basically the end. I don't know if people are interested. It kind of, it's a fascinating documentary. But anyway, how am I doing on time?
2 minutes.
So there you go. It's a trailer for the dreams then. So I guess I'll finish here. What's interesting to me is that the ones that I was pointing out, they're not really consuming the image in the same way that those other spectators, which you see at the end of the game, the ones, in this case, white, normally white, middle-class, affluent spectators, are consuming, right? So they're not consuming the game after a hard day's work. They're really studying the game, concentrating on the game as a kind of exercise in advancement or upliftment or whatever you want to call it, right? So if anything I could conclude, and I'd be curious to hear what others think, is that, you know, your relation to consumption, depending on your relationship to capitalism, your relation to the spectacle and consumption will be different, right? If we could say that in this short presentation, right? And so it's difficult to use the term, the kind of very big term in Marxism called alienation, really gets at some things but misses some things too. I mean, you could make an argument that these guys are alienated, but you'd have to make an argument that they're alienated in different ways than those who are merely just watching with a beer in hand, you know, to unwind after their long day of work, to go to the next day tomorrow. So anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.